What's up, bosses? Before we kick off this episode, I want to tell you about our sponsor this week. It is Rad Diversified REIT. Now, you're probably familiar with their CEO, Dutch Mendenhall. He's a good friend of the show. He's appeared on episodes 178 and 194, and Dutch was our most recent Boss Insider guest. He gave an awesome presentation all about the work that they're doing over at Rad. You can check out the full replay on our iLab Patreon account. He told us all about how Rad Diversified REIT allows investment partners to invest in cash flowing properties with substantial value add opportunities. Rad Diversified also offers monthly distributions, a 5% bottom line guarantee. They did a 36.7% return in 2020, and they've returned 33.42% in the last 12 months. So if you want to take a closer look at what Rad is doing, you just got to go to raddiversified.com/boss. That's Rad, R-A-D, Diversified, D-I-V-E-R-S-I-F-I-E-D.com. .com/BOSS. I'm going to tell you even more about Rad Diversified REIT during the break, but once again, if you want to check them out now, just go to raddiversified.com/boss. All right, let's kick off this episode.
Welcome to the Invest Like a Boss podcast.
I'm Sam Marks.
And I'm Johnny FD. We're self-made entrepreneurs who invest our own money and use modern technology to invest like a boss.
Join us each week for exclusive interviews with our network of modern investors, business owners, and multimillionaires to discover new ways to invest our hard-earned cash.
Hey bosses, this is Johnny and welcome to episode 206 of the Invest Like a Boss podcast. We're switching things up and we're having Derek come on. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well, Johnny. How are you? Yeah, we had Sam actually do this interview, so you're getting a little bit of everyone on this, trying a new format.
Yeah, and new formats are kind of the keyword for this episode as well. This one and the next episode is going to be about NFTs. It's really exciting these days with DeFi, with crypto, with NFTs. I'm going to be diving into all of that.
Yeah, this is one of those 101 episodes that is going to be really fun. I think that it's an episode that you can go back on hopefully years from now. And as this is all just evolving and this new way of looking at finance, this decentralized finance is what DeFi stands for. And this is just covering the basics. I'm sure we'll get into it deeper later, but this is really exciting new stuff. And I think on the surface, it's something that should interest you and I both, Johnny, considering we're both self-employed. And I think we've gone through the process of trying to get a loan traditionally through a bank. And if you are self-employed, it is not easy.
Yeah, it's very, very hard. It's almost impossible. Sam and I both cannot get loans more than like $200,000. And we have way more than that in, even in stocks. So you would think that they would be able to just hold as collateral, but it just doesn't work that way.
Definitely not. We'll talk about collateral and everything in the interview as well, because, these loans are secured with collateral, but it makes it a lot easier. And just going from one entity to another and not having that middleman of the bank or potentially a government watching you, this seems really interesting to me. So I'm excited to hear Sam kind of go through everything with our guest.
Yeah, definitely. And the funny thing is, because I'm bearish, or I would say more, less, more risk averse when it comes to investing in things like cryptocurrencies, I'm actually very bullish on DeFi. And it's because I've personally had so many experiences where, I'm out of the US. I need to transfer a large sum of money, whether it's $50,000 or $100,000, to someone who is either in another country or someone's, sending me that money from another country. And it's just a pain in the butt. This has happened at least maybe four or five times now. The first was I sold my dropshipping store for, it was something I can't even remember now. It's been so long, but I think it was at least $60,000. And I remember saying, all right, well, how do you want to give me the money? And he was American, I was American, but we were both in Thailand. And he was like, well, maybe we could just do a bank transfer. That failed because the bank was like, no, we're not doing that. We tried using PayPal. It worked for like a test, like a test transfer of like 10 grand. But then we tried to transfer the rest. We tried to do four of them and then they locked us out. My Chase account locked me out for 4 weeks. It was a nightmare. And this was an American to an American. And like, it became even more complicated when I was transferring money with, you know, like a friend from the EU or, you know, sending money to Ukraine.
Yeah. And not even foreign transactions, Johnny. I had this problem happen. I sold a car in the United States. It was not even just American to American in America. We were in the same state, in the same city. And we tried to use PayPal and all those kind of sorts. And it was like a week long process to get it all sent over at once. And it's just ridiculous how difficult everything has to be with these financial institutions.
Yeah. And on one hand, it is relatively safe because, you know, they do double confirm things. If you kind of mess up, you know, you'll probably end up getting saved, or at least you can call someone and try to claw it back or make sure it goes in the right account or, you know, or something, right? With crypto and DeFi, as we'll learn, all that's removed. So there's the pros and the cons of that. So that's scary. It's a bit risky, but I do think that there is a future for this because the need is huge. I mean, sending money, you know, through, you know, and you know, it's funny is like I even use PayPal as an example, even though now it seems like such an old kind of dinosaur. Just maybe what, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when Elon Musk was basically running it and it was called X.com, it was light years ahead of traditional banking. It was like, wow, this is amazing. You know, and now we have, you know, things like, you know, Cash App or Venmo, where we kind of easily send small amounts of money to each other. Like all that, I think, was kind of digital money 1.0, and DeFi is kind of the 2.0 or even the 3.0 version.
Yeah, totally. This is some really exciting stuff. And we got a great guest for this. His name's Clayton Roche. He's with DeFi Nation and the UMA project. So why don't we just jump right into it?
Yeah, let's do it. I'm excited. I'm excited to learn more about how DeFi works, but also actually how to potentially earn some money with DeFi and investments.
Awesome. Here's Sam and Clayton Roche.
All right, everyone, welcome back to a DeFi 101 episode. Man, I got a lot to learn on this. We're sitting here with Clayton Roche, and he is the founder of DeFi Nation. And also, you've been talking about this when a lot of people weren't talking about it, Clayton, when everyone was pretty bearish on the whole subject. So it's great to have you on the show. And man, we have a lot to talk about and a lot to learn.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. Appreciate you having me on, and excited to share some bits. And yeah, we were talking about it well before it became kind of the bull run that we're in today. And it's been an exciting journey. So excited to share some learnings.
Every time I start looking at crypto and or even DeFi is a relatively new term for me. Decentralized finance is not, but the first time I saw DeFi, I'm like, wait, what is that? Oh yeah, okay, it's decentralized finance. And yeah, all the components that are in it can be quite intimidating to dig into. At the same time, tons of money is being made, and it seems like we're at this massive shift in finance where we're migrating somewhat from traditional finance to decentralized finance. And I was hoping we could kind of start the episode and discussion just a little bit on that, like what kind of you see as the core difference in those two and how things are sort of now, even to the masses, it's being acknowledged that DeFi is something that's got a lot of steam behind it.
Sure. No, I think that's a great question. And the core differences that I would bring up are pretty fundamental. And essentially, it has to do with permissionlessness and this decentralized nature. And so permissionless means literally that anyone could start to participate in these financial tools, and you don't have to ask anyone's permission, and no one can take away your ability to participate. And so this comes from the fact that you can download an Ethereum or another blockchain wallet like onto your phone, and you could receive funds. You could receive $100,000 from someone sitting across from you at a coffee shop without asking anyone's permission and without anyone being able to stop you, basically. However, it's pseudo-anonymous. I'm not saying that someone can't notice and do something about it, but the permissionless aspect is there. So that's really big and interesting, right? And that differs quite a bit from traditional finance. The other bit is this decentralized piece. And so what's really fascinating about cryptocurrency in the context of DeFi is most of the time it's non-custodial. And so if you're holding funds, let's say you're holding that $100,000 at Starbucks and you want to give it to me, in most other non-cash transactions, there's a custodian who would take ownership of those funds in between that transaction. And so, and in fact, like a bank transfer, if the money is in your bank account, the bank is the one who is custodying it or technically owning it, right, for that duration. And so them sending it from one person to another doesn't even, it might change custodians in terms of the bank, it might change banks, right? But they're holding your funds this whole time. With DeFi, in this example I gave, the person on one side of the table is holding their money just like they would cash. Essentially, it's really just like that. And so there's no intermediary. And so what it really allows is to remove this middleman from finance. You don't need these custodians anymore. People can send the money from one person to another. And then, and I won't just ramble into a long monologue here, but there's all this other cool stuff that can be built on it. So you have, it's not just me sending money to you. It's like, well, I could borrow money from you. Well, what's your collateral? Then we start to talk about that. Or maybe we could gamble on something together, or we could invest on something together. And there's all these other layers that are being added onto it.
Yeah, so when it comes to the permissions, generally when in traditional finance, when we say permissions, and this is, I believe this directly speaks to what you were just talking about with custodians, is when the banks have the permission, right? When you send, if I sit next to you in a coffee shop and I send you $100,000 from my Bank of America, I'm actually having to get permission from Bank of America, and maybe the government has to approve that in some level. But with DeFi, no one's approving that. If I want to make that transaction happens, right?
That's exactly right.
So, yep. And I don't want to get in too much of a rabbit hole with this, but this just makes me think of the big question, which is why did governments allow this? Because this undermines the whole banking system and the Fed, the Federal Reserve. And it just seems sure. like, and I wonder if you think that is because it just got too big and they just said, we can't, it's too big now to put our hand into it. Sure. But do you have a view on any of that stuff?
Yeah, you know, just the standard caveat, right? Whatever a view I have is definitely mine alone and not any organization sure. I'm working with. And is also just going to be, you know, totally my personal bias. I've not researched yeah. this stuff in any great depth. However, yeah. I think there's maybe a tension between wanting to own the innovation and be the country that's responsible for this innovative tech boom. And so every country that is flexible about crypto, you know, attracts more people, attracts smart people there that want to build things. And then if they can be friendly to it, they can start to tax it. Yeah. And so there's a little bit of a market force there that hopefully will edge countries towards being open to it. The other, like more adversarial answer I might give you is they couldn't disallow it. Like that's what's right. cool about crypto, right? Like they can, in the sense of, they can do a couple things. They could try to detect it and imprison you if you use it. They, mm-hmm. and they also could, you know, I don't know, like just destroy the internet or something, right? Like there are ways to go after it in that regard. Mm-hmm. There isn't really a way to, short of an asteroid striking the earth kind of outcome, there's not really a way to just stop Bitcoin or stop Ethereum. But countries could start to do things to stop their citizens from accessing those networks. Mm-hmm. So that's one piece of it. And I also just think that nobody really knows exactly what to do about it just yet. You know, governments are still reacting to this piece of news. Just before I hopped on with you, I was reading a lawsuit. A plaintiff in New York filed against a DeFi protocol, which allows people to basically pool their money and buy lottery tickets with the interest that it earns. Mm-hmm. And this lawsuit is basically saying, like, look, you're running an illegal lottery, and you're also like exposing people to risk, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so, like, there's going to be all kinds of battles like this to come for sure,
sure.
as yeah. regulators decide how to handle it. And
very blurry. So we're sitting here in November 2021. I have a feeling this is going to be one of those timeless episodes that we'll go back and listen to catch up on, you know, terminologies and things, but also to just see like how things have changed. We listen to this episode in 5 years and think of some things. But I know just in the last 6 months, it seems like China has really cramped down, or at least they're posturing it, basically saying any crypto transactions will, are forbidden. You can get in trouble for it. But then the SEC of the US came out and said, we're not going to touch it. And so that was, I mean, that was major news, because I thought the US might try to follow China in a sense. But I think that speaks to your point where, like, they're kind of opening arms, they're inviting innovation to flood into the USA. And then maybe down the road, they're gonna come up with some interesting taxes on it.
Sure. Yeah, it's a bit of an unknown. It's always kind of an ongoing unknown. And I wouldn't even say that you could even like speak for the organizations in the US. Like I imagine it depends on who you talk to, mm-hmm. Even within those organizations, right?
Sure.
Like people are scurrying around trying to wrap their heads around the implications of this. And we're talking about some pretty major things. I mean, we're talking about tens of billions of dollars of like non-USD backed, but USD pegged stable coins, for example, mm-hmm. that they aren't backed by the dollar. And so they essentially become equivalent to euro dollars, I think, which affects the money supply, especially as it starts to grow. And these, like you mentioned, this affects like the Fed, this affects the yeah. underlying USD, all this stuff has implications for that.
Very interesting. There's a lot of terms when it comes to DeFi that actually they're pretty similar to traditional finance. They're just in decentralized finance. And so we wanted on this episode to just kind of cover some of the key pillars to get some of the terminology straightened out for ourselves. And then in future episodes, be able to go into these a little bit more in detail. But the first one that you just mentioned was stable coins. And stable coins is an interesting one that I know, frankly, pretty little about. You gave just a little bit of a background there, but maybe you could start by just telling us which some of the bigger stable coins are now and how they work.
Sure. So it's funny because stable coin is actually just means like it just means like dollars or euros as we know them.
Yeah.
They just have this special name in crypto to balance it off the fact that everything else is a volatile coin, mm-hmm. which is to say like Bitcoin and everything else. Mm-hmm. So stable coins just means, in most cases, it means something that's valued at the traditional value in the traditional finance world. And so the most common by far is dollar-backed or dollar-pegged stable coins. And peg just means it tracks roughly to the value of that dollar. Mm-hmm. There are tens of USD stable coins, and they all work a bit differently. There's a few that we would call centralized, where they actually have a bank account with an audited number of dollars in it, and it corresponds to the circulating number of these stable coins. Mm-hmm. So one of them is USDC, which is run by Circle and Coinbase. So Coinbase is a US company, and it has a legal contract, and it has this money in a bank. It's generally very well trusted. It's kind of the number one centralized stablecoin of decentralized finance. And then kind of the other comparison point would be DAI, which is spelled D-A-I. That is the number one decentralized stablecoin. The way that works is it's actually little, essentially, it's a debt against Ethereum, which is an asset, which is like Bitcoin's little brother is how I like to think of it. And I don't want to take you all down the rabbit hole too far on this, but essentially, instead of having a stablecoin dollar that's backed by a dollar, this is a DAI stablecoin that's worth a dollar, but it's backed by Ethereum. So it's backed by this other asset. Mm. And what's cool about that, and what's really cool about decentralized finance is that this stuff is all transparent. So if I were to buy DAI and then you start to look into DAI and what's behind it, you can actually see all of the collateral that's backing it. You can see this on chain. You can look into a blockchain explorer and see the assets that are there. And so you can validate that, in fact, these coins are backed by this Ethereum. It's all there. You can't mint an infinite amount of it. You can only create as much as you have collateral for. And so this differs from, for example, the US dollar, which doesn't need any collateral when minted by the federal, mm-hmm. by the central yeah. bank. Yeah. So that's a rough overview, but bounce back any questions you have, because
I guess the first one that pops off is just, why would anyone own a stable coin? If it's, let's just say in US dollar terms, why would you buy a stable coin that's pegged to the US dollar when that coin will have less utility than a dollar would in terms of yeah, in terms of purchasing?
Sure. Yeah, right. So like you can't walk into many stores and offer to pay with stable coins. Mm-hmm. No, that's a great question. And basically the answer is it offers you different utility. Mm-hmm. And so it allows you to lend and borrow and also keep in the DeFi ecosystem and earn very high yields, relatively speaking, like 800 times what you might expect to get in a savings account. And so that's a big part of it. Another piece of it is that people use it as a way to sideline their funds. So imagine you're a trader and you're buying Bitcoin. You might want to sell some Bitcoin, but you don't want to like sell it and go back to cash in your bank and then go back into Bitcoin. This allows you to stay in the crypto space and denominate your portfolio in dollars without having to pull all the way out. And you can easily change back into Bitcoin, for example. And yeah, and then just really like the reason I personally hold some stable coins is so that I can lend them out and earn quite a high yield compared to where I might otherwise.
I'm very interested in hearing about that next. Last question on the stable coin. This is a little bit of a heavier question, but I would imagine whoever's created these stable coins, in order for them to maintain the peg with, let's say, the dollar, they must be holding, someone buys $1 million worth of stable coins, they must have to take that million US dollar and somehow hold it in some type of reserve. So imagine that there's a little bit of counterparty risk here, where if the whoever's putting the stable coin together, the organization, does something else with those funds or gets those funds into a state of illiquidity, you might not be able to maintain a peg. I'm not a finance expert in that regard, but it seems like there might be some risk there.
There definitely is, Sam. And you're asking really, really good questions when it comes to the old rule of DYOR, do your own research in crypto. Each stablecoin has its unique properties. And so it's funny that you mentioned that specific thing, because there's USDC, which I generally trust, and they do have these audited accounts which have dollars to back them. There's also Tether, which supposedly has some amount of backing, but basically has been a bit opaque and is challenged generally across the space. It's one of these things that that trades at a dollar because everyone else trades it at a dollar, but there's always this looming risk or narrative potentially that it could start to collapse at some point. And of course, if there was illiquidity, it would start to trade less than a dollar. So that is a concern. The other answer to your question, though, is both of these are centralized stablecoins. This is where, you remember I mentioned to you about the DAI, which is backed by Ethereum. This is all on-chain visible code. And it's a little bit hard to wrap your head around until you kind of accept this idea of digital currency. But imagine that you could think of Ethereum a bit like gold. And so you can actually go in there and see that there's gold locked inside of this vault. And it's verifiable. It's publicly verifiable. And so you don't have any concern about that. However, here we're getting into cans of worms. However, there is what's called smart contract risk. And essentially, this stuff is all held together by code. And if the code had a flaw in it, it could be exploited or hacked. Now, what's nice about this is that DAI, for example, has been around for several years and has hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars in it by now. And so you could think of that as a bounty for someone to come in and steal it. Like, there's right now a $1 billion prize if you can break this. Well, no one's broken it. And so you can take that as a validation of its security level. But yeah, just giving you like a few different answers here. Definitely want to do your own research. And, you know, I mentioned these attractive yields. Well, part of the reason, you know this in finance across the board, right? This is like the number one financial rule, is like high rewards means underneath there somewhere is probably high risks.
Yeah. Well, this is the next part that I'm very interested in, because this is something that I've only heard recently with talking to some people that I know that invest in crypto. And they're making really good returns compared to bank savings accounts. I mean, we joke now that like with a Marcus savings account or just say a bank savings account that you get like 0.025% in, you're probably losing like 8% after inflation, right? I mean, it's just cash is trash right now. So when I heard that there is some actually some appealing call it interest rates on crypto, I got really interested, but I know nothing about it. So you had mentioned borrowing and lending, and I was hoping we could talk about that subject next.
Sure. There's actually a bunch of different ways to kind of talk about earning yield in crypto. Mm-hmm. And we will just focus on the borrowing and lending, which is going to have generally the more conservative rates. And so you might be looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of like 8 to 12% on USD stable coins.
Wow.
And that's the conservative.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Which is funny, like based on your quote about inflation rates, right? Like it at least allows you to keep up with inflation, we hope, right? Now, essentially the way that borrowing works in crypto is, you might ask, why is anyone borrowing money from you, right? Mm-hmm. Why is anyone going to borrow stable coins from you? And how can you believe that they're secured loans, right? Because this is people borrowing money from you. Well, why are you lending them money? Like who is this guy? It's some random digits on the computer. We don't even know who they are. Mm-hmm. What they've done is they have locked up collateral such as Bitcoin in order to borrow their funds. And essentially you are trusting the platform that you're using to liquidate them in the event that the value of their collateral would fall under the loan to value ratio. Mm-hmm. And so it's just like any other borrowing and lending when it comes to like margin accounts for trading, for example, where you might borrow funds from the platform in order to lever up. And they would do a margin call, right? If the value of your collateral starts to fall. Yeah. It's the same thing. There's just no margin call. You just have to pay attention and you might get liquidated if you're a borrower. But essentially that's what gives you the confidence as a lender.
Okay. And then you're lending peer to peer and there's no documentation on what that person's borrowing for. It's a house renovation. They want to use it to lever up on crypto investing. It's
correct that there's no documentation on what it's for, but all you need confidence in is that they are properly secured, right? Like a bank, nobody cares what you're borrowing the money for as long as they trust. It's just like a pawn shop, right? The pawn shop doesn't ask you why you're borrowing the money as long as what you gave them is worth more than the loan.
Yeah. So are they able to borrow up to do they have to collateralize up to the exact amount that they are lending, or do they have a little bit of margin?
They have to actually over collateralize. And that's because, and so for example, it depends on the platform, but the loan to value ratio, which just refers to like how much you can borrow against the value of your collateral, that ratio depends on the volatility of the asset that you are posting as collateral. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense, right? Because if Bitcoin, you're lending Bitcoin, for example, and if the value of Bitcoin historically could drop 20% overnight, you need to be confident that you can liquidate that Bitcoin and protect the lenders quickly enough. And so that's why you actually need them to be over collateralized. And this is a bit of a capital inefficiency in DeFi right now, because we don't have a credit system. We don't really have a way to lend people money more than they can already secure.
Yeah. So good as a lender, not as great as a borrower. And actually it makes sense, because there's probably so many people that made a ton of money in their cryptos in holdings, but don't want to liquidate it yet. They need, is it safe to say that they're borrowing for all types of expenses, not just for leveraging more crypto investments? They might be taking the USDC and turning it into US dollars and building a house or something like that. They could be doing anything with it, right?
Absolutely. All of those things are possible. Depends. There's a few common narratives on what people are doing. One is they're borrowing money to buy more Bitcoin or buy more Ethereum because they're bullish and they want to have more exposure. The other common narrative is that if you don't sell your crypto, you don't need to pay taxes on it right then. So you can just borrow against it. Right. And if you believe, you know, what Ethereum between March of last year and March of this year, I think went over 10x, or may have been 20 or 30x or something. if you have an, if you believe that it's going to continue on that path, I mean, you would borrow indefinitely at 8 or 12% APY, right, and never sell, right?
Yeah.
So that's another thing this, that people are doing.
This seems like something that I need to be doing immediately, like right when we get off the call. What are some of the favorite platforms that you use to do the lending or borrowing?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So this raises kind of this big decision around, do you want to go centralized or decentralized?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll try to be brief, and you can ask me some follow-up questions if you want. Decentralized means like having your own wallet, having your own passphrase, which is the kind of crypto security key that you use to log in and access your funds. It's scarier, it's riskier for you because you can mess it up. Mm-hmm. I would encourage everyone in the world to get good at it and to learn how to do it, because I think it's an important, cool thing. However, the easiest way is to go with a centralized custodian service, such as Nexo is actually my preferred one, NEXO. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they allow you to, if you're in the US anyway, and they service a lot of countries, but I can speak most clearly about the US. You can create a Coinbase account and a Nexo account. You can withdraw dollars from your bank account into Coinbase to buy USDC. Fee-free, there's no fees for this. Then you need to send the USDC to Nexo and you can start earning 8% right away, 8% APY, and which works out to like 7.7% APR. And what's cool about that is, like, let's say you took 10K out of your bank through Coinbase, you put it into Nexo, it takes about 24 hours maybe to get from point A to point Z there. Mm-hmm. And each day you'll receive a little disbursement of your owed interest.
That's gonna be my next question. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it is awesome. And like, even though I know what the number is gonna be, I check it almost daily just to just to enjoy a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
And psychologically, it's cool. It makes you want to save. It makes you experience the opportunity of cost of money a little bit more saliently, right? It's like, well, if I spend this money on this today, that's actually, you know, this additional money I'd be losing in the future.
Definitely.
Although,
I used to have a Fidelity bank account when I was like 8 years old, and I would get $10 for allowance, and I put that allowance in the bank. But that's when interest rates were like 8% or something. And so every quarter I would get a statement on this paper thing, and it would actually show money, like real money being deposited, you know, like $4 or $5, which to like a 6 year old was like, dude, I can go buy the nicest new Lego set. It's amazing. Savings awesome. But unfortunately, until this, you know, that hasn't been a reality for a lot of younger people out there to be able to understand that. Yep. So, okay. So lending, borrowing, you mentioned Nexo, definitely going to check that out. And Nexo is centralized, correct?
That's right.
Okay, so there's maybe a little bit more risk in using a centralized versus a decentralized one.
I wouldn't say that off the top of my head, because it's just a different kind of risk. You're risking, for example, that they might run off with the money or have some sort of error. They do have insurance to cover certain scenarios. There's kind of these different layers of risk, because you're trusting the stable coin that you're holding. You're also trusting that platform. So you can kind of look into their history, you can look into their reputation, et cetera. Mm-hmm. However, you're removing most of the personal risk. I think you're removing the risk that you lose access to your own crypto wallet. It's really, most people are going to create a crypto wallet. They're going to write down their secret phrase, and they're going to lose it. And then their computer's going to break, and they're going to lose access to their money forever. I mean, it is literally, there's no one you can call on the phone if that happens. Like it is physically lost, like burning cash in fire. So that's it's just a different kind of risk. And I think if we're to have a rule of thumb for the duration of this call, it's just to diversify a little bit. And so, like, for example, I have some funds in both types. I have some that custody and some that are in these custodial platforms.
Makes sense. The next term I wanted to talk about was staking. It's something that I, again, know pretty little about, but I wanted to know, does this have to do with lending and borrowing? Is it in the same group or is it something totally different?
Sure. So staking is pretty interesting. What you're doing when you stake assets is you're locking them in a contract either for a set period of time or just for as long as you want. And you start to earn a return as you do so. Now, the reason for staking can vary. Like why would somebody want you to stake an asset that you're not lending, for example? Well, in some cases, these tokens, these crypto assets are their governance tokens, and they are used to vote. And so you might be delegating your voting power to someone else. And so you might be being paid for your voting power. And so you earn a return for staking those assets there. Another thing that happens with staking is you're actually a liquidity provider. And so that's actually pretty similar to lending. It's just that instead of lending your money to a peer that's going to do something with it, you are providing it as market liquidity so that assets can trade elsewhere. And so that's like another piece of it. So like you, to compare to traditional finance, you have market makers who might put orders on an order book to help trading work better. Same idea in DeFi. The exchanges work a little bit differently, but that's part of what you're doing. Another reason for staking is actually just, it's kind of funny to explain, but there are protocols that are being launched today, and they are trying to distribute the ownership of their protocol to people. They want a wide distribution, and you can stake your assets, the ones that they've approved, to earn these tokens. Now, all you're really doing is signaling to them that you own these tokens and that you're interested in receiving their tokens. And just as one concrete example, right now today, I'm earning like about 90% APY on my company's token, which is UMA, in this platform called FiatDAO. They're launching their new product, and they're using this mechanism to distribute their tokens to the world. My UMA tokens that are locked in there aren't serving any purpose. All they're doing is they've designed the system. They're using it as a way to signal your dedication or maybe just signal that I'm an UMA token holder and I'm earning these other tokens. So it's just kind of a distribution method that's gained popularity.
So they can't take those tokens from you at any point, right? You're staking them for a certain amount of time. Do you mind sharing what the duration is of this stake?
So the duration is up to me. Essentially, for this particular example, I think it's only going to run for 4 weeks, this particular promotion, this particular distribution period. So it's not like this is forever or anything.
Yeah.
And they pay out once a week. And so if I pulled out early, I think I would forego the week I was interrupting, I would forego those rewards because they pay out once a week in this example. And then your other point is, yes, they can't take these tokens from me. The contract that it's being staked into, when I say contract, I just mean the code, is all publicly viewable. It's been audited, and it has been like this model has been used previously. There's always risk associated with it. Like, I won't say that there's not, but I can say that, like, with as much certainty as I'm comfortable, these contracts have been reviewed, and there's no indication that the people launching it could like run off with the money, for example.
Okay. Now, could you do staking with the kind of primary coins being Bitcoin and Ethereum? I'm just saying primary because that's what I think most people listening to this episode are familiar with. And I think that's actually just a broader question. It's like, for people that own Bitcoin and Ethereum, including myself, what are the ways that you can make money off of that, I guess, through staking and or lending, borrowing?
Sure. So there's a few different ways, depending on the asset, depending on what direction you want to go. Mm-hmm. I am currently, I have some Ethereum on Nexo. And what's cool is you can earn 4% right now. In fact, actually, you can earn 4% on your Ethereum coin in Nexo. You can actually up it to 5% if you lock it for a month at a time.
Wow.
So you won't be able to interrupt that. And that's great.
It's like a 4-year bank CD.
yeah, it's incredible, right? For 1 month. Or 4% with no lock.
Yeah.
So that's very nice. I really enjoy that. And actually, that's fairly competitive, even in across like the DeFi space. It's not super easy to find like really profitable ways to stake Ethereum or Bitcoin that are as easy as that. There is a cross protocol, which is has been launched actually by my team, where you can stake your Ethereum and earn about 3% in a decentralized way. And what you're doing is you're providing liquidity for this bridging feature. Essentially there, it's sort of like lending is a really easy way to think of it. Mm-hmm. And then there's Convex Finance, which I enjoy. And what Convex Finance and other platforms like Lido also do is they help you participate in the ETH2 staking, which has to do with the next Ethereum that's going to launch in the next year or two, which is a proof of stake mechanism. And the way that that works is you stake your Ethereum and you earn some of the rewards from the fees in the network and from the inflation. Mm-hmm. And there's ways to participate in that directly, or there's ways to use these intermediaries to help you do it. Yeah. So I realize I'm just rambling these different things out there. There's just like a lot of ways, and it depends on how deep you want to get into it.
Yeah.
It depends on how much you have too, because gas fees, the fees to transact in a decentralized way, like on chain Ethereum today are like exorbitantly high. Mm-hmm. And so you have to have, you know, maybe you want to have $100,000 worth before you would stake it somewhere for anything less than a year, because, or maybe not a year, maybe a couple months, just because it takes a lot of gas fees to get it in there.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to pay $100 to start earning that 8%. Well, you have to calculate your cost benefit there. It depends on how much you have.
So when I was reading into some of this stuff regarding lending and staking, I was thinking to myself, I'm like, gosh, this is like, I'm not going to do it because it's too complicated for me. And then I compared it to, say, like, okay, a bank CD, right? I go in my market savings account. They're offering, at, let's say 2 years ago, they're offering 2%. Click a button, 12 months minimum, but it's literally like two clicks. And that's how easy bank CDs got. But actually behind the scenes of bank CDs, there's complicated procedures that are going on. That money's being held, then that money's being lended out. And there's all types of different protocols and stuff and ledgers that manage that that transaction and that interest that's paid back to you. And if you got into the weeds of all that, you would say, oh, this is like, it's just too complicated. Like, I'm not going to do it for 2%, right? And I think that's part of the challenge now, is like when you're reading into this stuff for the first time, it sounds extremely complicated. And I know a lot of it is, but once it gets to a point where it's just as simple as like, hey, click two buttons. Do you want to make 8% paid out daily? That type of thing. And maybe it is already. It's just, I'm only reading the literature and I'm like, this is too complicated. I'm never going to be able to do it with any type of confidence. But with this, with the borrowing or even the staking, is it to that degree that simple, especially using like a centralized exchange or platform?
Yeah, you raised some very good points, and it can be overwhelming, and I get overwhelmed. Like, it's funny that you say that. So we're talking about these things and there are just levels upon levels, and I can start reading about it and be like, oh, I don't want to bother with this. So the advice that I would give for people in this situation is actually to go with that centralized route, at least to get a taste of it. And you might be looking at, again, I can only use kind of the USA perspective, but as an American, if you already have a bank account and you want to set up Coinbase and Nexo, you might be looking at 2 or 3 hours of doing things like taking a selfie to validate your ID. And there's invariably going to be some like weird little glitch that you have to be patient through. But it's worth it. It is worth it to kind of get to that level. That's how I would suggest people kind of get started. It's nice if you have a buddy that wants to spend a few minutes with you to sit next to you that's already done it. That can be nice. But yeah, I would totally advise people to get started in that centralized way, even though I'm sort of speaking blasphemy to the like purists of the world in this space.
Yeah.
I think it's the best way to get your foot in the door.
Yeah, I got hammered in Mt. Gox back in 2014. So I still have a bit of a trust issue with forking over quite a bit of money. But
of course.
So with Nexo, then you would want to do your own due diligence on Nexo, who's behind it, and make sure that you thought that there was integrity in that platform.
That's right. And there's also other very comparable platforms like BlockFi and Celsius are two others that stand out to me. So yeah, you're exactly right. You would want to do your own due diligence there. I would just basically, you know, you asked this question around, or you raised this topic around it being an intimidating amount of stuff you need to do. And this is where I'd suggest people get started. I wouldn't suggest they get started with all of their money, right?
Yeah.
I would just suggest that people throw some in there. They log in, they watch the payouts coming. Maybe they buy a little bit of Ethereum while they're on Nexo and start to earn some interest there. It's just like it's a good starting point, I guess.
I'm doing it immediately after this. This is like one of those things. I'm like, I should have been doing this for a long time now, damn it. One of the other pillars, Clayton, I guess I've always thought of exchanges as just like an exchange, right? A Coinbase is an exchange, but there's also centralized exchanges and decentralized exchanges, it seems. Could you just explain the difference in those and maybe share a couple of examples?
Absolutely. So the examples of centralized exchanges that are most common would be Coinbase and Binance stand out as, and then there's a ton, there's hundreds of centralized exchanges all over the world. And then decentralized exchanges, the top ones would be Uniswap, Bancor, SushiSwap. And there's a handful of others too. The core difference is that in a centralized exchange, we talked about this issue of custody, right? Whereby the institution is actually owning your funds. You have a, what you have is a deposit slip, essentially, saying that they owe you this amount of money. And obviously, if they don't honor those deposit slips, you won't use their service, and they're managing like a bank or a normal business. With a decentralized exchange, there's almost an equivalent of a deposit slip, except it's not a matter of trusting anyone. You deposit there's two components with a decentralized exchange. You don't actually need to deposit your money in and then make a trade and then withdraw it. Instead, you can actually just do a swap. And so with Uniswap, for example, let's say I wanted to change Ethereum into Bitcoin or Ether into Bitcoin. I would send the Ether to the Uniswap pool and I would receive back Bitcoin as one transaction. And what's cool about this is under the hood, what's actually happening is Uniswap has pooled tens of millions of dollars, or maybe hundreds of millions of dollars of Ethereum and of Ether and Bitcoin in what's called an automated market maker pool. And what these things do is they have a kind of a ratio of Bitcoin to Ethereum that they're going to price this out at. And sorry, I'm gonna take it one level higher. I'm not gonna go so deep here. Basically, people have dumped a bunch of money in there and a bunch of Ether and Bitcoin in there to earn fees. When you make a trade, you are paying a small fee to do that, comparable to the centralized exchanges typically. And those fees go to the people who are liquidity providers, and you, but at no point in there is anyone else custodying your funds. They're just in this contract. And so even the liquidity providers' funds are in this contract. They have what's called an LP token, or liquidity provider token, which is essentially an IOU token that they can say, okay, I'm done earning my fees. I'm going to send back this token and I'm going to receive back my Ether and my Bitcoin that I was using to earn fees on. That's the big picture.
So would the centralized exchanges be much bigger organizations? Like the decentralized exchanges still have an organization, still have people that would have to code and write logic and sort of manage it, but they wouldn't need as big of a team as a centralized exchange. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, to answer your question, they are typically bigger. Yeah. And what's very cool about a decentralized exchange is this code is out there forever. Literally no one, unless you can actually take down Ethereum, no one can take Uniswap out of the world. And everyone who created it can disappear or never work on it again. And that exchange is out there, and your money that's in there can be traded, or you can continue to use it in perpetuity. And this kind of comes back to that permissionless bit, whereby, and decentralized bit, whereby, like, once this stuff is out there in the world, it is unstoppable.
Yeah. So at the core of all this, we're talking about decentralized DeFi. We've talked about some companies like Coinbase. Would you consider Coinbase part of decentralized finance or just components of it?
Like, look, is it decentralized finance? It's not decentralized. So I would say no in that regard. Mm-hmm. However, I think, you know, we just had this conversation where I promoted using Coinbase as a gateway drug to DeFi. Mm-hmm. So like, I think they're playing a part in it. They're playing a really important part of standing between the two sides.
Mm-hmm. How big do you think DeFi can get? Do you think this overtakes traditional finance in the years ahead? Or do you have any visions or projections of how you see this continuing to evolve?
Sure. I struggle with being making predictions about things, like I almost refuse to, but I think that it could, and I think that it probably will. It's just a question of maybe, I don't know, there's really a lot of cool things that are happening that are unexpected. Yeah, I think that it will. I'm giving a rambling answer here. I think that it will. I think that it's not necessarily clear that it's going to look like that it's going to be on the same trajectory we're on today, if that makes sense. So a comparable example is like when the first internet bubble happened, right? Like the internet clearly was important and took off, but it didn't take off from its first start, right? It had like a second start where it finally took off. I don't know if we're on that first start right now or not. Mm-hmm. But I think definitely, I mean, this technology is so superior to what we have today, and it's wild. It's wild to view the inefficiencies that I have to experience when I use the traditional banking system, for example.
Sure.
I think there's going to be a certain amount of resistance and a certain amount of fits and starts, but I think it's inevitable for sure.
Okay. Hey, man, this has been a great 101 episode. I know there's a lot we can go into deeper. So I hope and look forward to hopefully having you back on the show down the road to get into the weeds of some more stuff. Besides DeFi Nation, is there any other thing or any ways people could get a hold of you or follow what you're doing? I'm certainly interested myself.
Yeah, I think the best way would be on Twitter. So my Twitter handle is Token Architect. Mm-hmm. And then I guess a couple other, if I can make a couple plugs on where I hang out or what I think is relevant. Is that all right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So DeFi Nation is just a Facebook group. People could hop in there if they want. My company is Uma. And if you want to join our community, it's on Discord. You can go to discord.umaproject.org. That's UMA project. And what's cool about that is you can start to get involved in one of the communities that's behind decentralized finance. And we actually have a group of people that get paid a fairly good chunk of money in crypto assets to participate in our community. And they're basically helping to build what we're up to. And so that's also another way in. If you want to learn, you want to contribute some time and knowledge, you can go that route. The other thing I would mention, and they're actually launching their token tomorrow, is this protocol called SyncDAO, SyncDAO. And what they are doing is focusing on bringing affiliate rewards to DeFi. And so essentially the idea would be that you could learn from someone else how to access DeFi, and they would, that person would earn like a certain sliver of your returns for that education. The reason I'm mentioning that is there's an opportunity for people to become experts and also earn because of it, or an opportunity to get handheld into it a little bit if you want. So that's also an interesting avenue. All of the things I've mentioned, I have some personal stake in, so full disclosure on those.
Awesome.
Yeah.
and I just thought for the listeners to be interested, what country are you in again?
I'm in Kyrgyzstan, which is just south of Kazakhstan. Yep.
Kyrgyzstan. I bet no one knows how to spell that. They haven't visited it before. It's a tricky one.
It took me a while. It took me a while after for autocorrect not to fix it for me.
Listeners, links to all that in the show notes. Clayton, have a great afternoon in Kyrgyzstan.
Awesome. Thanks, Sam. Cheers.
This week's sponsor of Invest Like a Boss is Rad Diversified REIT. They have built something that has proven to thrive in good and bad economic times. I'm going to give you 7 reasons that make Rad Diversified REIT a fund you should consider. Number 1, Rad Diversified REIT has customizable payouts. Create how you want your money to work for you. Number 2, Rad Diversified has amassed a portfolio of $67 million in member partnerships. Number 3, in 2019, Rad had an annualized return of 44%. Number 4, Rad offers monthly distributions, a 5% bottom line guarantee. You can even check out their SEC filing when you head over to raddiversified.com/boss. Number 5, Rad kept its entire staff employed during the pandemic and took 0 government assistance while aggressively acquiring assets. Number 6, for over a decade, CEO Dutch Mendenhall has been educating others in real estate and streamlining how he acquires properties. And number 7, you can invest in Rad for as little as $1,000. Dutch's expertise in residential, commercial, multifamily homes, and even income-producing farms like the American Survivalist Projects, which we recently talked about on episode 194, if you want to go back and check that out, is helping to bridge the gap between the rich and the middle class. You can learn more by heading to raddiversified.com/boss and see how you can be a part of a fund that is a step above others. That's raddiversified.com/boss. RADDIVERSIFIED.com/BOSS. Wow, so much to unpack in there that we're going to get into. But first, Johnny, I just want to do a little test here.
Okay.
Tell me, without looking it up, how do you spell the country of Kyrgyzstan?
It's definitely like K-R-Y-G, maybe a Z somewhere, Y-S-T-A-N or something.
Oh, you're really close. You actually just did a couple of letters backwards. So it's K-Y-R-G-Y-Z-S-T-A-N.
Nice.
Anyways, what did you think of the episode? I don't even know where to start. I'm really excited about all this now, and it made a lot more sense. I've always kind of saw DeFi from afar and go, oh, that looks interesting, but haven't really taken the time to dig into it. And I think this kind of pushed me into it more.
Yeah, actually, me too. I actually got really excited. And I mean, I guess on a couple fronts, right? One is I'm excited that there are very smart people creating tools that will help make transfers easier in the future. And whether it will become fully separate and decentralized, or you know, it would be through a second party or third party, or even if they just integrate into our existing platforms that we're comfortable with, you know, like I would be perfectly happy if my US bank or my PayPal or something just use this technology to let me transfer things instantly. I would be so much happier instead of paying some crazy 2.9% plus 30 cents fee every time I want to use something, or having insane exchange rates, when someone wants to sell me something, send me British pounds or euros. Things like Wise work well for that now, but it feels like I have 5 different, platforms on, how to actually get paid. And it's insane.
Yeah, I think that'd be really amazing. That's kind of where I see a problem with this too, is that's such a cash generator for the banks and financial institutions that I don't see any way that they either A, don't jump into this market and try to push those fees on as being, obviously we already have some of these centralized platforms anyways, or B, somehow getting lobbyists to get government to ban a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, I can see that. But I also see that, the US wants innovation and technology, and there's going to be a lot of money in this. And the US is kind of like the early days of the internet. But they say, we don't even know how we're going to tax it yet. We don't know how we're going to, keep everything in line. But let's just kind of let them do their thing, and eventually we'll figure it out. We kind of forget that for the first, 10, 20 years, there was this huge loophole where there was no, like everything bought online was sales tax free. How insane is it that it took them that long to start taxing people for buying things online?
Yeah, I want to say it's only within like the last 10 years or so that we've had to actually pay tax on that stuff.
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, like literally you know, when I left the US 10 years ago, I still never paid anything. Like, and I think the only time, even 5 years ago, I remember I would only have to collect tax if my customer was in the same state I was in, you know, and I was, my company was based in Wyoming and no one ever bought anything from there.
Yeah, the population's so small, you barely ever have to run into that issue. So I guess let's start with the earning potential, because as we know, the banks, even a Marcus or Ally that claim they're a high interest rate bank, aren't paying anything. I think the highest offer I saw the other day was, I got, you know, one of those mail ones. I want to say it was like American Express or someone, and it was high interest savings account, and it was 0.5%. Mm-hmm. With inflation, that doesn't cover anything. You're losing money just having cash sit in the bank. So what do you think about this potential of just holding your coins in these accounts and letting them just earn interest?
So actually, I have actually been doing that. If you guys listening, you know, that took a listen to my last quarterly update on the Patreon group, I put a snippety, like, you know, not a huge amount, you know, I think it was only 3% of my total net worth, but still like a significant amount, still like 30 grand worth of Ether into something called Celsius, which he mentioned on this episode, which I was happy that he mentioned. And I've been collecting, I think it's something like 5 or 6% interest, just sitting there.
So I think it makes sense to shop around, because I've been looking, I looked at this Nexo platform that he mentioned, and that's actually earning 8% interest over at Nexo for Ether. And it's, and you said 5 to 6 for yours. And I've been looking around. I was doing Gemini. I also have an account where I have a little bit of money in, and their Ether only pays 2%. So these rates really vary where you're looking. So I think it makes sense to shop around at some of these bigger platforms that are some of the more trusted ones that are out there now.
Yeah, that's true. But also remember, a lot of that is marketing, where like, to get the 8%, you have to, you know, kind of jump through these hoops, or it's only for like, it was some crazy things, like you have to have certain amounts of their coin as well, or something silly.
Yeah, I'm just reading over it quick, but it does say up to 8%. So I'm sure there's some kind of catch to that.
Yeah, and you know, and that's the biggest problem. I got so excited. Like, I think that was the only reason why I kind of even started, like, you know, in the first place. You know, I have it open right now. I actually just made an account with Nexo after you talked about it. And I was really excited. I'm like, okay, yeah, I'll happily earn up to 12% with one of these US Tether coins. And then I took a look and I was like, okay, what is this complication? You know, and I think that's kind of what how they get you. I don't know if these companies purposely make things complicated or. You know, just kind of like skim off of that, or if that's kind of just, you know, it is just a complicated thing.
So I haven't done this yet, but I'm really interested in moving some of my coins into something like this. Mm-hmm. What's the cash out policy? Because it says you get daily interest and payouts. So if I just have it in there for a week, can I pull out 100% of my money plus whatever little amount of interest I made? Or is there some kind of catch with that?
I don't know. I haven't looked at that yet, but usually there's some kind of, you know, it's funny. They say that DeFi and crypto has, you know, like, we're avoiding the bank fees that we hate, right? You know, I hate the PayPal's 2.9% fees or the $15 wire transfer fee. But what they don't tell you is Ether gas fee is insanely high, you know, or to convert from Ether to Bitcoin, to Tether, to USDC, or, you know, especially back to US dollar. It's insanely crazy high to even buy, you know, crypto in the first place. It's expensive, and people don't really account for those fees. You know, if I'm losing $300 every time I make a transaction, how long does it take me to make that back?
Sure, that makes sense. I think the USDC, if you're buying it in Coinbase, there is no charge. Don't quote me on that, but I think there isn't. But that makes sense if you're using these other currencies with the fees. You know, you got to think that you're gonna have to hold it long enough just to get those fees back.
Yeah. So I'm taking a look at Nexo right now. So if I want to invest in their stable coins, which says up to 12%, it really is actually just 8%. And the only way I can get more is if I choose to get paid in Nexo tokens, which
that's a red flag.
Yeah. So it's their coins, you know. It's like saying I want to get paid in Chuck E. Cheese tokens. or I have to hold, you know, X amount of percentage of Nexo tokens in my portfolio. So if I have 10% of my portfolio in Nexo tokens, then I can get that 2%. So basically, they just want you to buy their tokens. And this is kind of the same thing with all these companies. You know, I have a Celsius account as well. And it's the same thing. If you want the high interest, you get their tokens, which inherently are completely worthless. They might be worth something. They might have some kind of utility, but they definitely have no actual, stable value.
I see that now. They have a tricky little toggle button that I didn't see before, and it's either earn in kind or earn in Nexo, where you get the extra 2%. So as much as these DeFi's platforms are saying, you know, we're not like the banks, I'm seeing a lot of things that they are very similar to the banks.
Yeah, 100%. So I don't know. It is tricky, but what I do like about potentially investing or saving, I guess, in some kind of stablecoin that I didn't know before this is actually that they're backed by not just 100% kind of backed by crypto. It's actually backed by 125%. So let's say you want to borrow $100,000, you have to actually have $125,000 worth of Bitcoin or Ether, because they know that this is going to fluctuate.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I wanted to bring that up as well. And 125, actually, from what I've been looking into, is on the low end. A lot of them are 150 to 200% of the value of the loan is what you got to put up for collateral. But when you got, if you're using to reinvest into crypto and you think crypto is going to continue on the tear that it's been going on, I think you'll happily put that up. You know, you'll pay, it's the rate started about 7% APR. I think you'll pay that if you think that Bitcoin's going to go up another 30, 40% when it's gone up, 500% in the last year. If you really believe that this is the future and all this stuff is just going to go up, why wouldn't you pay 7% to make 50, 100, 200%?
Yeah. So that is absolutely true. At the same time, if you're going to do that, I don't know. It's kind of like a catch-22, right? Where the only people who would pay, 12% interest. So first off, paying 12% interest to invest in something is insane, right? Like if I told you, do you want to buy this house? It could potentially go up in value, but you're paying a 12% annual, interest-free mortgage. It's probably not a good idea. And to do that, to buy something as volatile and risky as cryptocurrency is even crazier. It's even more risky. So if there is a big crash, and who knows, what the future is going to be. I mean, the markets have been insane this last 2 years. But if there is a big crash, all these people are going to get not only just wiped out, but they're going to get wiped out for way more than they're worth.
Yeah, this is super high risk, I think. I think I equate this to when you see a lot of the home flippers or a lot of these big construction loans. They're shorter term loans, and you see, let's take my Fundrise account for example. They give you updates on projects, and they go, "Well, this company just paid back this loan that we charged them 12% interest on." I'm thinking, who is paying 12% interest on a loan when rates are in the threes and fours on a long term mortgage? Well, it's because it's a shorter term. And they see an investment that's going to pay off, but it is so much riskier. I definitely agree with that. I want to say a lot of these loans that they're getting are from these crypto millionaires that haven't really, I guess, mentally earned this money. It's just a number that they're looking at in a computer, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it doesn't feel like a risk to them because they got it so easily.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. I mean, there's a term called Bitcoin, like maximalist, who their sole belief is Bitcoin's going to go to 100,000 or, to a million or whatever it is. And they're just diehard fanatics about that.
When it's almost like a social status, like swagger, like look at how big my number is. And it doesn't mean anything because you're not using it for anything, but it's kind of a social marker of look how much Bitcoin I have, look how much Dogecoin or whatever it is that I have.
Yeah. And I guess this, you know, things like, you know, borrowing against it allows them to actually, I guess, then transfer it to US dollar, I guess, or something else, and actually buy things with it. I mean, exactly, how would that even work, right? Let's say I have 100 grand worth of Bitcoin. I take a loan against it, pay 12%. I get 100 grand worth of USDT or USDC.
Yep.
And then I guess I have to transfer that then into actual US dollars to buy something, because, you know, nobody's taking USDT.
Yeah, so you would send it to your Coinbase or whatever account you have, and then transfer that into a bank account if you wanted to use it for cash.
Yeah, so there's a lot of steps, and you're still going through a bank.
Right. It's not as decentralized as it sounds. Decentralized would be, hey, Johnny, can you pay me my salary in Bitcoin this month? Something like that.
Yeah. And, you know, at the same time, like, I mean, that's happening a little bit more and more. Like, for example, I've taken Bitcoin and Ether as payment recently for things like consulting, right? Somebody wanted to pay me $175 to pick my brain for 45 minutes. And they offered to pay me in Bitcoin and Ether. And I said, yeah, sure. And the reason why I was happy to take Bitcoin is I wouldn't have bought it otherwise. And now it's kind of just like, you know, saying like, hey, Johnny, do you want to get paid for an hour of your time in lottery tickets? I'm like, yeah, sure. That actually sounds like a good idea. You know, and the same, I actually did a sponsored ad on my YouTube channel for some crazy NFT game. It looks terrible, but it's on the if you go to YouTube, search Johnny FD, look for the video of me playing VR for the first time with Bottom Bankrupt. And halfway through, about 10 minutes in, I do the most insane ad you've ever seen. And I did it over the top on purpose, just so people, and I wrote ad, sponsored ad, not investment advice, all over it, just so people would know.
Sure.
But I had them pay me in their crazy, like, you know, duck tokens, which then I transferred immediately into Ether. And I'm like, all right, well, this is just free money that I didn't actually, you know, take out of my pocket. So whatever happens, happens.
I mean, if it had value right away to convert into a coin that you more trust, I think that's okay. I wouldn't want to get paid 100%, I guess, in tokens and coins. And it's just too much of a step now, because obviously, at least here in the US where I am, we're still using the US dollar a lot. But as far as an alternative, I'm open to it as well.
I was going to say, Derek, we're going to start paying you in duck coin from now on.
All right. We have the iLab coin.
Oh, God. So speaking of these coins and these investments, are you planning on investing in any of these things?
So I think I want to do I want to look into the earning thing more. I'm going to shop around. Nexo looks interesting. The Gemini, just because I already have a Gemini account, seems really easy. And I think... does Coinbase have this now? Because I use the Coinbase Pro version, which is weird because you think Pro would mean it has more features, but it actually has less. I'm going to look into it because I am really interested. I was really excited about doing the loan piece and maybe doing a small loan and potentially, you know, reinvesting it back into more crypto, because I think leveraging debt into that seems like a really interesting space. Nothing too crazy, but a small loan just to try it out. But then I thought, you know, I work so hard to get debt free and I don't owe anybody anything. Just to mentally have the fact that I know I owe somebody something right now just doesn't interest me as much as I'm excited about the potential return. Mentally, just knowing that I have a bill or I owe somebody something when right now I'm scot-free and don't owe anybody anything. That's kind of a turnoff for me, though.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I would 100% not borrow against my Ether. I'd rather have it just sit there. And you know what? To me, you know, having it sit there in something like Celsius and earn 60% interest, I'm perfectly happy with, because I'm taking the gamble that it could potentially go up. But either way, it's earning 6%. And I'm just hoping that it doesn't crash. And I'm hoping it doesn't get hacked or stolen or just somehow other disappear, like a lot of crypto does, you know? And I know that this is actually still safer than me having like a cold storage or hardware wallet, because I'll probably for sure lose that, especially while I'm traveling around. So, you know, I'm like, all right, that's just there. I know it's a gamble. I will mark my words. I will never have more than 10% of my total net worth in anything crypto related. So even if this all goes to crap, which there is a significant chance it will, you know, definitely greater than zero, probably greater than 50%,
yeah,
by my estimations. Then I lose 10% of my net worth. It sucks, but you know, that's, you know, not the end of the world. But if it does go up, and in the meantime, it is fun. It is very, very exciting.
I'm in the same boat. I was at like 5% of my net worth. I went a little crazy in the last few months and put more in there. And I'm up to just about 10%. And I don't plan on really adding any more into crypto currently, unless something really excites me. So yeah, I think that's a good rule. I think we used to say 5%, but it's looking more that, you know, I think you're safe going up to 10%. And if 10% destroys your entire life, you're doing something wrong.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, and for me, my number for high risk, high reward investments was always 10%. But that included things like, you know, Art of FX or, you know, anything that was kind of like not stocks or real estate or, you know, something that's kind of backed. So that's kind of my rule I'm going to stay with.
Awesome. So really interesting episode. Thanks to Clayton for coming on, Sam for doing the interview. If you guys like this format, let us know, where all three of us kind of chime in at the Boss Lounge. You can find the link at investlikeaboss.com, on Patreon, of course. That's investlikeaboss.com. Click become a Patreon. And let me get a quick 5-star review in here, because we've had a ton come in since we're talking about it again, and they really do help the show. AJ Abrams wrote on Tuesday of this week, "Finally, a finance investment podcast that is easy to understand, fun to listen to, and spans several related and current topics, keeping things interesting. And going back to the older episodes, I've noticed the consistency of both Sam and Johnny as well. They're not afraid to disagree with each other, ask challenging questions, and go against the popular opinion. I look forward to new episodes each week." Thanks for that review, AJ. Apple Podcasts, if you can leave a 5-star review. Doesn't have to be long, just a couple words is great. The 5 stars is what's really important. We appreciate it, guys.
Yeah, we love that. And actually, but you know what? That long review is awesome. You know, it's nice to hear people's backstory. So thank you so much, AJ. And Derek, thank you for coming on, hanging out. It's been fun.
Yeah, thanks, Johnny. Really quick, I want to say one more thing, because I forgot. If you're listening to this episode new, head over to Boss Lounge or Invest Like a Boss. Any of our social media, it's all at Invest Like a Boss. There's a survey we have. It's really important that we want to get your guys' feedback, because we're coming into 2022 and we want to make the show better than ever. And by you participating in that survey, it really helps us guide the show on where we should go. All right, I'm done, Johnny.
Oh, no. You didn't tell me the best part is by filling out the survey and telling us your opinion of the show, we're going to put you into a raffle to win $50 worth of Bitcoin.
And then you can earn 10% interest on that Bitcoin.
Asterisk, which is actually probably 6%. But still, you'll get something. So yeah, just head over to investlikeaboss.com, fill out that survey. It's going to help us out a lot. Just let us know, you know, just kind of basic information on what you expect of the show, what you want, how we can make it even more better for your cheddar. All right, Derek, I'll see you next week. Bye, guys.
All right, see ya.
Thanks for listening to the Invest Like a Boss podcast. Join our mailing list at investlikeaboss.com to get exclusive access to our insider investment portfolios and our private members forum.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends and leave us a review in the iTunes store. It helps more than you know. See you guys next week.